You're listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast.
On this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast, we go back to the event that just took place at the JP Morgan Chase Science Technology Headquarters in Palo Alto, conquering the M&A game. Right now, this episode is panel two, where we really dive into the processes. We find out a ton of information about things that are, well, not talked about that often in a transaction. So let's start this week's episode of the Silicon Valley Podcast. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Silicon Valley Podcast with your host, Sean Flynn, who interviews famous entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and leaders in tech. Learn their secrets and see tomorrow's world today.
All right. Now with that, let's go down this panel. Starting with John, who is our pitch hitter that jumped in at the last minute to save the day. Give a brief introduction of yourself. Let's go to Karen and Angelo. John.
Okay. Good evening, everybody. Pleasure to meet all of you. Hopefully, I'll get to spend some time networking with many of you. John Murata. I live over in the East Bay. Is this okay? Is this too loud?
Okay.
I've been doing post-merger integration work for 17 years. Started off as a consultant and then went in-house and now back to consulting. Most recent gig, I was a chief operating officer at M&A Science, which is a software platform designed specifically for M&A pipeline management and then post-merger integration. Now I do consulting work within the Bay Area.
All right, Karen.
Karen Traversi, and I work with CEOs that are going through transition or disruption M&A or want to do M&A or growth sizing up or extending value. So I look at ways to optimize revenue. And usually connecting the dots, that means between parts of the organization that don't play well in the sandbox together, looking at purchase versus partnering and other kinds of fun activities like that. I've had a career of acquisition all the way to public and acquisition all the way to transitioning out. So I've been the upside and the downside of M&A and other transaction events.
Right. And the best dressed gentleman on the stage today.
Thank you. Angela. I think that was a compliment. Dressed to impress, right? So Angelo DeSando, commercial insurance specialist at DeSando Insurance Services. Our firm was actually started by my father in 1978. It was actually a farmer's agency. And in 2006, I got started with him and my vision was to be a brokerage. So in 2010, I started the firm over again as an independent brokerage, specializing on protecting business owners. And so that's what I do. I handle their workers' comp, their liability. I'll do surety bonds, commercial property, auto. Basically, you name it to protect a business, that's what we do. And that's in my wheelhouse. So I've been unique enough to be in this industry now for 18 years, to be very young, been blessed to be able to start very young and have many years of experience underneath my belt.
All right. And I'm moderating the panel, but I am going to be pretty active in this panel. So my name is Sean Flynn. I'm an investment banker focused on mergers, acquisition, growth capital, middle market. And before going to the panel, how many here are familiar with the transaction process from start to end? Not too many hands. I'm surprised. Okay. So a brief overview of what a transaction would look like. You have that phase at the very beginning where you're putting all the information together in a data room, you're compiling it. Then you're building the market materials from it, the buyer's list. Then you go out to market. From that, you'll get feedback, indication of interest, or letter of intent, one before the other, or you might not do the indication of interest process, go straight to the LOI. From that, you get something signed, and then you're in due diligence, maybe 60, 90 days to close in definitive documents. So that whole process, 6 to 9 months, right? And you're probably thinking, how could it last that long? But you think about it, putting all the information together. Okay, 4 weeks. Building the market material, 4 to 6 weeks. Going out to market, 8 weeks, 10 weeks. Getting feedback, filtering that funnel down to that one LOI, maybe another 4 weeks. Due diligence, 60 days, that goes over to 90 days. Add all that up, 8 to 9 months. Maybe some of that goes really quick, maybe even as little as 4 months. But this is a long process with a lot of steps in it. So I guess first question for the panel up here, what experts do you bring in for an M&A process?
I'm shocked that you say 9 months. I think it's longer than 9 months, but I appreciate
I've been in due diligence for 1 year on one project.
Okay. So I appreciate that. So I think whenever you start moving into it, obviously you've got the financial piece that you have to look at, but the expert, there's real estate, there's all your financial components, but there's the things that I think are often left behind that come in really early is what's the purpose of your desire for transaction? And is it, are you looking to expand a market? Are you looking to expand product? Are you looking for intellectual property? What are the reasonings? Because those will also impact the other experts that you have to bring in. So there might be technology folks that have to look at that to evaluate if it's reasonable for it. So I think those have to happen even before the LOI, or you're making decisions on a company that might not align to the reason behind your original desire to do a transaction.
Now, is that on the buy side or the sell side?
Oh, yeah, that would be on the sell side. And the buy. Actually, I think it's on both. So when you're selling, you're trying to, if you're going to stick around, you're looking for something that aligns with it. And on the buy side, if you're looking to expand your market, you're looking for technology, you're looking for IP, you have to know what you're looking for and then provide the people that can help you find that specific thing. Those are some of them.
From my background is actually working with large enterprises and strategics. So typically on the buy side, which is the transactions I tend to work on, I'm an operator, so I'm going to go right deep into the things that you have to look for. So during diligence, we will typically bring in, and we are in Silicon Valley, so I'm going to talk tech. We'll typically bring in a consulting firm that has a specialty in the particular technology that's being acquired, and whether there's a match between the incumbent technology and the one that you're acquiring. For example, if you're doing a lot of on-premise data centers, if you're going to buy a cloud company, how does that fold over? So we'll definitely look into that. Typically from the perspective of the role that I play, which is integration management office, we often play more of a governing role to make sure that as you progress, we step through the process progressively, and then we bring in the experts necessary to deliver on the specific risks and issues that might bubble up as you go through the actual diligence process. And then we do the same thing. We repeat it after close. We'll bring those experts back and make sure that they actually execute against the architecture that was presented during the buy process.
So you'd mentioned risk there. How important is it that everyone involved knows the risk tolerance of everyone else? For example, is it important to know that, you know, the lawyer that you're working with has high risk tolerance or low risk tolerance? The accountant, like, how important is it that everyone's aware of each other? And also for the audience, if you want any of the volume raised or lowered, we've seen some of this right now, let us know. We'll talk to Justin, our sound guy, to get all that tuned perfect. But going back to the panel, how important is it to know everyone's risk tolerance that you're working with?
Critical. So I actually think having everybody with the same risk tolerance is rare. And I also think that oftentimes which audiences should be part of analysis are left out. So even people working with your employees have an outcome, right? They're looking for sustained jobs, benefits, whatever it might be. Someone doing a buy, if you don't have them in your mind or doing a sell, you might not bring them along in the process mentally. I'm not saying that you have to tell them everything. So you've got your stakeholders, your executives, and your board that probably have one level of risk. You have your financial team, you have your lawyers, you have your employees, you have your clients that have a different risk, or once the transaction starts and integration starts. So I do think you need to have your strategic planning group, and those decision makers must be aware of the variances of risk. I don't know that every group needs to know about everybody else, but the people making the decisions need to be aware of that, because it will impact how the deal does and then how integration happens. Yeah.
Agreed. We're keeping this real, right? Mm-hmm. This is like the real thing.
Yeah. We're going to edit and post. Yeah.
Okay. So the way you look at it is from the buy side perspective, the company that's buying another company, they are probably the most risk adverse, right? They're going to take a conservative position in the company that they're acquiring, or they're presenting the deal papers again. On the sell side, you want a company that's more free with risk, right? Because there are a lot of things you might have that still need to get worked out or processes that need to get finished. So you want, on the sell side, you want companies that are going to acquire you who are like, oh, okay, that's okay for now. So, right, there are two competing risk appetites that are happening at any point during the deal cycle. You as the founder, for example, you're going to have to move up and down emotionally through that entire process. So be ready for great days, be ready for not so great days through that entire process, which that's where people like Aaron and I, we tend to be more of the diplomat. So we're more even keeled in that we present both sides of the equation, meaning here are the risks, here are the pros and cons if you do this or that. And that's where we spend a lot of our time, is just really playing out scenarios so that everybody understands what you're getting into.
And speaking of risk, Angela, you're the insurance guy. Tell us a little about your role in all this.
Absolutely. Risk, everyone thinks about insurance. Oh, insurance, let's think about that second to none. It's always last thing on people's lists, and sometimes it can be complex and takes a lot of due diligence to get a deal done and a lot of working to get something done. So on the risk side, workers' comp is really what's going to be really key, because when you're doing an acquisition, if you're acquiring 50% or more of those employees, you're going to be taking on what they call is the experience rating modifier, which is the XMOD, which is the major rating factor on a workers' comp premium. And especially when you're focusing on blue collar acquisitions, that could make or break a company. I've seen companies go out of business because they can't afford the workers' comp costs, especially here in California where fraud is running rampant. And so knowing that what the XMOD is and how that's going to affect a company, maybe it's a company that's already in existence and they're acquiring their competitor in the same industry, their XMOD will actually be merged into their current XMOD. So that will affect their current pricing. If they are a new company looking to acquire to get into the industry, they have to also assume those costs as well. So that's definitely something that I could help on in regards to taking a look at that and educating the business owner on, let's look at the claims. Have you ever actually dived into the workers' comp claims? Have you seen what the employee claims have looked like? And yeah, that's my feedback that I give back.
Question on feedback, the whole process at the very beginning. What are some of the, value drivers that could be there? And John's smiling because he knows that could be an entire day. Softball question for the panel here. What are some value drivers when you're looking at a company or to acquire or to sell that you either want to push or hide or that?
Well, in insurance, I've seen a lot of value come into a company that actually has a low XMOD. So basically what an XMOD, anything below 100 is going to be a credit on their workers' comp premium. And this credit's coming from the state of California. So you could have one company that has 100% surcharge on their rates and they're hunting in the industry for a company that is exactly what they're doing, but has a better XMOD rating factor, because as soon as they acquire them, they're able to assume that XMOD into their pricing. So that immediately gives price reduction on their workers' comp costs. And especially if you're dealing with in construction, this can be tens of thousands of dollars in premium costs.
So I think we'll get real. I've said this to Sean. I think that when you go back to what was the purpose of the transaction, value either way can be determined or hidden. If the purpose was, for example, had a client where they loved the sales process, they wanted to buy this company, particularly because it was an amazing hockey stick in sales. That's what they cared about. It was going to get them into market. What they didn't look at, how quickly they fell off the backside and what kind of clients those were. And so when they did the integration, the deal was done. It did not meld. It didn't work with their long term. So in truth, valuation, there are some easy things that go through due diligence that people know when they're working with their financial teams. But if you're talking about it for your individual purpose behind your transaction, it is more in the weeds, it is more operational, and it is what is the end result supposed to be. And if it is supposed to be, for example, in that example, an amazing sales group that's going to close deals quickly, but they were not aligned with the business and the way that they wanted the business to go, and it did not sustain, and in the end, the company did not sustain. So that is something where you would have shown the hockey stick, you would hide your client base and the things behind it. So I think valuation is also often made the statements are too easy, and they're not. It's not all just a piece of paper and math. There's more to it when you come down to it.
For the panel, when should the integration team start having a look at the deal target from the buy side? And when should the sell side start talking to the integration team? John?
Yeah, he teed that one up for me. So the way that it would work in a perfect world is that your integration team, typically on the buy side, will involve that team the moment that the letter of intent is signed. The reason is because for a large transaction, it will require a lot of people to start moving to get things prepared in order to move through that transaction. So I worked for a company where we had multiple floors, and the moment that I stepped onto a floor, you would see people just scatter. They're like, oh, John's coming. He needs something. The way that I typically think of the integration management office is we basically beg, borrow, and steal other people's time. So we don't typically have like a pure army of IMO people running transactions. Why? Because transactions can go 3 months, and then you go a little bit quiet, and then another 3 months, you'll get busy again. From that perspective, on the buy side, we try to get involved as early as possible so we can be part of the diligence process. Why? Because at the end of the day, who's on the hook to deliver everything? That's us. So the earlier that we know what's going on, the risk and the issues that bubble up, we can mitigate them very quickly.
Aaron, anything to add? If not, question on how important is leadership to the success of a transaction?
Leadership's everything, but I do think it's clarity of leadership. So I spend a lot of time, because I'm working with that group, so reminding, again, I go, and you'll hear it from me the whole day, what was the original purpose and what is your intent when you're done? More so of what company do you want to build? What do you want it to look like? Are you bringing along your people? Are you bringing along your client? This is, again, if I'm selling, if I'm buying, what is your intent in bringing that group in? Are you hoping to keep them on board? Even if you don't know the details, like mentally, where are you? Because then the leadership has to be able to articulate that in both their day-to-day practices, but also in the way that they're continuing to develop the business and spend time on the business, because you will see in deals that the business at hand falls away, right? Leadership can be distracted by executing the process of a transaction. They can be distracted by the shiny bauble of what might be next. And you will very quickly lose what you had as your base value, meaning your company. You lose the people's attention that are doing the day-to-day work. You're losing people. This is before the transactions you've gotten far enough down. So I think leadership has to be very clear on what they want in terms of either buying or selling. Leadership has to be able to stand up and be strong about where they're going, support the challenges, have the hard conversations, because there are many, and then be very pragmatic in what the outcomes are going to be.
What are some questions that not the buyer, but the seller forgets to ask the buyer? What the seller forgets to ask the buyer.
I got one.
I got a few. I can pipe in, but John, if you want to go first.
Yes. So I'll go first. The one that I often run into is, how complicated are your policies? Doing policy harmonization is a very difficult task, because typically as a larger company, if you are a public company, there's a lot of scrutiny on the policies that you have and the processes that you have. When you're acquiring a smaller company, those policies are a little bit looser, right? So trying to merge them together, or getting the employees who are from the target company to comply with the more complicated, larger, stricter policies, can be quite difficult. Why is that important to consider? It's because if you're slowing down the ability to create a product, that will impact your NPS, right? Your net promoter score, because customers may not really like how slow you're moving and returning features or putting features out. Possibly at the same time, for those who are dev folks or who work in product, if you're feeling constrained by your ability to be creative because of new policies, that might cause you to attrit. So there are a lot of downstream implications if you find that policies can be too difficult to handle, especially as an acquired company.
Angelo, are there any questions on the insurance side that people forget to ask?
I think you and I could talk about the situation on the D&O tail coverage. Directors and officers, if there's multiple owners of a company, you're going to have a D&O policy. And that is a claims-made policy, meaning that when a claim comes in, there's only coverage as long as a policy is in place, which is a difference to an occurrence form, is as long as there is a coverage during the time of when the claim happened, then you have coverage. So when an acquisition happens, you want to make sure that you are purchasing, or you factor it into the purchase of a tail extension. Usually it's 3 years, 5 years, or up to seven. And so that gives protection in case something happens after the fact. And
she, I gave an example.
Yeah, she gave an example. So it kind of sparked my, I was like, oh yeah, tail coverage, it's super key. So
what about key man insurance and that?
Yeah, key man is definitely important. That helps, I think, with, you're talking about leadership, right? So I think the key man policy is a key on helping leadership. Key man policy is going to your key person that you have. Maybe it's a salesperson. Sometimes when an acquisition happens, they're like, oh, maybe I want to start looking for another job, because sometimes people can fumble transactions and it can be scary times, right? So you put a policy in place that is saying, hey, we're going through this transition. As long as you stay with us for X amount of period of time, you're going to get this policy. And they typically type it into like universal life insurance policy, which built cash value and compounds and whatnot. So that's a traditional vehicle that the key man policy can be used for.
What about reps and warranties?
Reps and warranties? Okay, yeah. Go for it. Talk about it.
You want me to?
Yeah. Brought it up.
Yeah. So typically in a deal, as you get further along the process and folks are making these big claims about the company, typically there's something called the reps and warranties, representations and warranties. So that is effectively, if there's a legal team around here, you can feel free to correct me, but it's basically the exit clause that says, as a founder or as a startup that's being acquired, if you're claiming that you have 4 million in revenue or ARR and you actually have 3.7, I can exit this deal. So reps and warranties are extremely important because they set the precedence upon which when the buyer presents this buy plan or the justification up to their board to get approval to buy you for 25 million, if you can't meet the reps and warranties, we can exit the deal. Okay, so that is another version of insurance that typically we have and we employ so that we don't get burned later on by buying a company that really didn't meet what the expectation was.
Are there other areas that you see common clauses or common, this destroyed the deal, this blew it up? I'm handing you softballs.
You got
days on that one.
I'll stop talking, you go.
Angelo, Karen, anyone? Okay, so let's see. How many different ways could a deal get blown up? You could have, I don't know, engineers that are overseas that you don't have employee contracts for, and then when you try to get them in due diligence, a war starts and you can't find them. Hypothetically, that could kill a deal. Let's see another one that could hypothetically happen. Maybe someone that is you thought was the lawyer of the lender says to say, well, hypothetically say this money is needed a week from now. He goes, yeah, I'll introduce you to this lender who's a kind of a gambler guy, high net worth individual. Out of nowhere, he says, I'm no longer representing the client. And if you want me to make an introduction, you got to give me 2 points on this deal. And after he's seen the data room and knows everything, and you think that's highly unethical, but he's doing it anyway. Let's see. What are some other ways the list can go?
Can go on and on.
It is endless.
We have a question.
Oh,
yeah.
Background checks for the due diligence.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of it. Finding out the other side, depending on who's acquiring, they'll have their third party consultants go out there and background check on the key people, insurance, everything. There's a lot of money that goes into a lot of effort. John, do you want to add more, Karen?
Another thing is when the deal drags on, it kills a deal.
The fatigue.
So both financially, the people who are selling, oddly enough, during the length, think they should get even more. I don't know, just from time, not sure. So oftentimes they get more and more disenchanted with whatever the amount was. And I've seen this happen quite a bit. And on the other side, there's more and more frustration. Plus they're uncovering because you've started some process and they're uncovering more. I think the bigger issue, because I go back to operations as well, is that all of this stuff, whether you think you're quiet or not, it's out there. Everybody knows. So you start to see attrition of both your internal teams and your clients. It's a big fall off. And so the value, especially if obviously that's a part of the company, right? Your client base, your revenue streams, those start to decrease, which then creates new flags in the discussions around what the revenue is. And that happens a lot. So especially you take anything too long and the discussions blow up, but that's a really big one.
Just to emphasize that even more, that's a strategy sometimes on the other side. To prolong things so that you start missing some of those numbers. And then once you miss those numbers, hey, you didn't hit this. You didn't hit those metrics that was in your pro forma that we had picked up. We're going to have to retrade this. So going back to a question I had asked earlier, what are some questions that sellers forget to ask buyers? Some of the ones I actually really like before we, you know, go to the LOI is just asking those parties that have submitted LOIs, hey, in the last 5 years, how many LOIs did you submit that were signed that you retraded the deals in due diligence? Or, hey, how many of those LOIs did you close? And if they say out of 10, we closed 8, what happened to those other two? And finding out that information, because that changes a lot of the value of those LOIs really quickly, right? When you find out this one person submits an LOI to everyone, but closes none versus this other person that, or other group that if they submit it, they're closing, like they're honor bound. So it's huge. You want to say something?
No, I'll compliment your statement, which is the question I would ask first and foremost is, do you have the money? How about that? Which is, if you're going to buy my company for $25 million, do you actually have the money, or do you have to go, do you have to do LBO, right? Leverage buyout? Do you have to go get the money from a bank? Like, where is it in the process? Like, if you're a founder, like, you don't want to go through the hassle of waiting 30, 60 days for them to get the money so they can pay you. Right? You want it all there. So that'd be my big thing, is just ask for the money first.
I see that a lot with search funds. When they search fund, so I'm not sure who here knows what a search fund is. So you have an entrepreneur that maybe went to Stanford or that, instead of going to VC or private equity or that, they have all these connections and they say, hey, I'm going to go buy this business. I'm going to have a little percentage, but you're giving me all the money to buy it. I'm going to operate it, and 3 to 5 years from now, we'll sell it. And we'll get a lot of LOIs from these people and we're going, wait a second, this is 60 days due diligence. This is 60 days. 120 days due diligence. What's going on here? Oh, wait, this is a search fund. Okay, because they have to go out and raise the money because they don't have the capital. So seeing that more and more. Okay, guys, we got just about 2 minutes left of this panel. Does anyone want to give like a key takeaway for the audience? And now for the panel, key takeaway. And if anyone wants to get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Oh, sure. Key takeaway would be, if you're a founder or you're working with founders, the first thing I would consider is, please get your data room in order. If they haven't done so already, go spin one up. Box, Dropbox are not really, they're not expensive, but really just have this. You can, and by the way, just go on the web. You can find the index of what folders typically people will look through as you go through a transaction, build those folders in, and then start putting your documents in there, such as articles of incorporation, your board notes, your quarterly business reviews, right? Start putting them in. Get the behavior going now, so that the founder, when the time comes 3 years later, when they're ready to go, it's instituted, right? And you have that history tracked. How to get to me, I'm on LinkedIn, or please feel free to catch me throughout the day. I'll be here to the very end.
I would say the key takeaway is, know what your intention is in any transaction and what your vision is post-transaction. Because if you can't clearly understand that and articulate that, then the teams you've put together cannot make it happen. So it's complicated as it is, and it's more complicated to keep it going that way. So that would be probably my biggest takeaway. And same, I'm on LinkedIn and I'm around. It's probably the best way to get me now.
I guess my key takeaway would be, don't think of insurance as the last thing on your mind. Hopefully think of it as a forefront. What does the coverages look like currently right now? What are they possibly going to look like in the future? And how can I implement something so we have protection going on in the future? I'm also on LinkedIn. Who's not? If you're not, must be living under a rock, right? But you can feel free to grab me and get business cards on me as well. Thanks.
All right. And I guess my takeaway, I was going to say what you said, but I think you already said that other than happy birthday to James. It's a long process, 6 to 9 months, maybe even longer. As I mentioned, I think I alluded, I was in due diligence for 1 year on one deal. And the founders and everyone there, that's a long process. And if you're not planning for the long road, you're going to just mentally not be there. You're going to check out. Things are going to slide. So know going into it, it's not going to happen over a weekend. It's not going to happen over a week. On that 6 months in, your family could say, hey, we should be on a vacation now. You promised me this. You promised me a new house. You promised me all these other things. And you're going to be mentally drained from that, mentally drained from the business, mentally drained from the transaction, because it's pulling you in all directions. So plan in advance, as our first panel said, for the long transaction, as talking on our second panel. And I think we got two more amazing panels coming. Is that right? All right. 10-minute break, everyone. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Silicon Valley Podcast. To access our resources, visit us at thesiliconvalleypodcast.com and follow our host on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Sean Flynn SV. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional.